Chapter 11. What is it? You have honored me by making a proposal for my niece's hand. For the present, with best thanks and respects, I beg to decline it. Why? Because you are not rich enough. The objection, as the speaker had foreseen, took Vendale completely by surprise. For the moment he was speechless. Your income is $1,500 a year, pursued Abenreezer. In my miserable country I should fall on my knees before your income, and say, what a princely fortune. In wealthy England, I sit as I am, and say, a modest independence, dear sir, nothing more. Enough, perhaps, for a wife in your own rank of life who has no social prejudices to conquer. Not more than half enough for a wife who is a meanly born foreigner, and who has all your social prejudices against her. Sir. If my niece is ever to marry you, she will have what you call uphill work of it in taking her place at starting. Yes, yes, this is not your view, but it remains, immovably remains, my view for all that. For my niece's sake, I claim that this uphill work shall be made as smooth as possible. Whatever material advantages she can have to help her, ought, in common justice, to be hers. Now, tell me, Mr. Vendale, on your $1,500 a year can your wife have a house in a fashionable quarter, a footman to open her door, a butler to wait at her table, and a carriage and horses to drive about in? I see the answer in your face. Your face says, no. Very good. Tell me one more thing, and I have done. Take the mass of your educated, accomplished, and lovely countrywomen, is it, or is it not, the fact that a lady who has a house in a fashionable quarter, a footman to open her door, a butler to wait at her table, and a carriage and horses to drive about in, is a lady who has gained 4 steps, in female estimation, at starting? Yes, or no? Come to the point, said Vendale. You view this question as a question of terms. What are your terms? The lowest terms, dear sir, on which you can provide your wife with those 4 steps at starting. Double your present income. The most rigid economy cannot do it in England unless. You said just now that you expected greatly to increase the value of your business. To work and increase it. I am a good devil after all. On the day when you satisfy me, by plain proofs, that your income has risen to $3,000 a year, ask me for my niece's hand, and it is yours. May I inquire if you have mentioned this arrangement to Miss Abenreezer? Certainly. She has a last little morsel of regard still left for me, Mr. Vendale, which is not yours yet, and she accepts my terms. In other words, she submits to be guided by her guardian's regard for her welfare, and by her guardian's superior knowledge of the world. He threw himself back in his chair, in firm reliance on his position, and in full possession of his excellent temper. Any open assertion of his own interests, in the situation in which Vendale was now placed, seemed to be, for the present at least, hopeless. He found himself literally left with no ground to stand on. Whether Abenreezer's objections were the genuine product of Abenreezer's own view of the case, or whether he was simply delaying the marriage in the hope of ultimately breaking it off altogether, in either of these events, any present resistance on Vendale's part would be equally useless. There was no help for it but to yield, making the best terms that he could on his own side. I protest against the conditions you impose on me, he began. Naturally, said Abenreezer, I dare say I should protest, myself, in your place. Say, however, pursued Vendale, that I accept your terms. In that case, I must be permitted to make 2 stipulations on my part. In the first place, I shall expect to be allowed to see your niece. Aha! To see my niece? And to make her in as great a hurry, to be married as you are yourself? Suppose I say, no? You would see her perhaps without my permission? Decidedly. How delightfully frank. How exquisitely English. You shall see her, Mr. Vendale, on certain days, which we will appoint together. What next? Your objection to my income. proceeded Vendale, has taken me completely by surprise. I wish to be assured against any repetition of that surprise. Your present views of my qualification for marriage require me to have an income of $3,000 a year. Can I be certain, in the future, as your experience of England enlarges, that your estimate will rise no higher? In plain English, said Abenreezer, you doubt my word? Do you purpose to take my word for it when I inform you that I have doubled my income? Asked Vendale. If my memory does not deceive me, you stipulated, a minute since, four plain proofs? Well played, Mr. Vendale. You combine the foreign quickness with the English solidity. Accept my best congratulations. Accept, also, my written guarantee. He rose, seated himself at a writing desk at a side table, wrote a few lines, and presented them to Vendale with a low bow. The engagement was perfectly explicit, and was signed and dated with scrupulous care. Are you satisfied with your guarantee?
I am satisfied.
Charmed to hear it, I am sure. We have had our little skirmish. We have really been wonderfully clever on both sides. For the present, our affairs are settled. I bear no malice.
You bear no malice.
Come, Mr. Vendale, a good English shake hands. Vendale gave his hand, a little bewildered by Abenreezer's sudden transitions from one humor to another. When may I expect to see Miss Abenreezer again? He asked, as he rose to go. Honor me with a visit tomorrow, said Abenreezer, and we will settle it then. Do have a grog before you go.
No?
Well. Well, we will reserve the grog till you have your $3,000 a year, and are ready to be married.
Aha! When will that be?
I made an estimate, some months since, of the capacities of my business, said Vendale. If that estimate is correct, I shall double my present income and be married, added Abenreezer.
And be married, repeated Vendale, within a year from this time.
Good night. Vendale makes mischief. When Vendale entered his office the next morning, the dull commercial routine at Cripple Corner met him with a new face. Marguerite had an interest in it now. The whole machinery which Wilding's death had set in motion, to realize the value of the business, the balancing of ledgers, the estimating of debts, the taking of stock, and the rest of it was now transformed into machinery which indicated the chances for and against a speedy marriage. After looking over results, as presented by his accountant, and checking additions and subtractions, as rendered by the clerks, Vendale turned his attention to the stock-taking department next, and sent a message to the sellers, desiring to see the report. The sellerman's appearance, the moment he put his head in at the door of his master's private room, suggested that something very extraordinary must have happened that morning. There was an approach to alacrity in Joey Ladle's movements. There was something which actually simulated cheerfulness in Joey Ladle's face. What's the matter? Asked Vendale. Anything wrong?
I should wish to mention one thing, answered Joey.
Young Mr. Vendale, I have never set myself up for a profit.
Whoever said you did?
No profit, as far as I've heard I tell of that profession, proceeded Joey, ever lived principally underground. No prophet, whatever else he might take in at the pores, ever took in wine from morning to night, for a number of years together. When I said to young Master Wilding, respecting his changing the name of the firm, that one of these days he might find he'd changed the luck of the firm, did I put myself forward as a prophet?
No, I didn't.
Has what I said to him come true?
Yes, it has.
In the time of Peblis and Nephew, young Mr. Vendale, no such thing was ever known as a mistake made in a consignment delivered at these doors. There's a mistake been made now. Please to remark that it happened before Miss Margaret came here. For which reason it don't go against what I've said respecting Miss Margaret singing round the luck.
Read that, sir, concluded Joey, pointing attention to a special passage in the report, with a forefinger which appeared to be in process of taking in through the pores nothing more remarkable than dirt. It's foreign to my nature to crow over the house I serve, but I feel it a kind of solemn duty to ask you to read that. Vendale read as follows. Note, respecting the Swiss champagne. An irregularity has been discovered in the last consignment received from the firm of De Fresnier and Company. Vendale stopped and referred to a memorandum book by his side. That was in Mr. Wilding's time, he said. The vintage was a particularly good one, and he took the whole of it. The Swiss champagne has done very well, hasn't it? I don't say it's done badly, answered the cellarman. It may have got sick in our customers' bins, or it may have bust in our customers' hands. But I don't say it's done badly with us. Vendale resumed the reading of the note. We find the number of the cases to be quite correct by the books. But six of them, which present a slight difference from the rest in the brand, have been opened, and have been found to contain a red wine instead of champagne. The similarity in the brands, we suppose, caused a mistake to be made in sending the consignment from Neuchâtel. The error has not been found to extend beyond six cases. Is that all? Exclaimed Vendale, tossing the note away from him. Joey Ladles, I followed the flying morsel of paper drearily. I'm glad to see you take it easy, sir, he said. Whatever happens, it will be always a comfort to you to remember that you took it easy at first. Sometimes one mistake leads to another. A man drops a bit of orange peel on the pavement by mistake, and another man treads on it by mistake, and there's a job at the hospital, and a party crippled for life. I'm glad you take it easy, sir. In Peblis and Nephew's time we shouldn't have taken it easy till we had seen the end of it. Without desiring to crow over the house, young Mr. Vendale, I wish you well through it. No offense, sir, said the cellarman, opening the door to go out, and looking in again ominously, before he shut it. I'm muddled and melancholy, I grant you. But I'm an old servant of Peblis and Nephew, and I wish you well through them six cases of red wine. Left by himself, Vendale laughed, and took up his pen. I may as well send a line to De Fresnier and Company, he thought, before I forget it. He wrote at once in these terms. Dear sirs, we are taking stock, and a trifling mistake has been discovered in the last consignment of champagne sent by your house to ours. Six of the cases contain red wine which we hereby return to you. The matter can easily be set right, either by your sending us six cases of the champagne, if they can be produced, or, if not, by your crediting us with the value of six cases on the amount last paid, £500, by our firm to yours. Your faithful servants, Wilding & Co. This letter dispatched to the post, the subject dropped at once out of Vendale's mind. He had other and far more interesting matters to think of. Later in the day he paid the visit to a Benreiser which had been agreed on between them. Certain evenings in the week were set apart which he was privileged to spend with Marguerite always, however, in the presence of a third person. On this stipulation a Benreiser politely but positively insisted. The one concession he made was to give Vendale his choice of who the third person should be. Confiding in past experience, his choice fell unhesitatingly upon the excellent woman who mended a Benreiser's stockings. On hearing of the responsibility entrusted to her, Madame Dor's intellectual nature burst suddenly into a new stage of development. She waited till a Benreiser's eye was off her, and then she looked at Vendale, and dimly winked. The time passed, the happy evenings with Marguerite came and went. It was the 10th morning since Vendale had written to the Swiss firm, when the answer appeared, on his desk, with the other letters of the day. Dear sirs, we beg to offer our excuses for the little mistake which has happened. At the same time, we regret to add, that the statement of our error, with which you have favored us, has led to a very unexpected discovery. The affair is a most serious one for you and for us. The particulars are as follows. Having no more champagne of the vintage last sent to you, we made arrangements to credit your firm to the value of 6 cases, as suggested by yourself. On taking this step, certain forms observed in our mode of doing business necessitated a reference to our banker's book, as well as to our ledger. The result is a moral certainty that no such remittance as you mentioned can have reached our house, and a literal certainty that no such remittance has been paid to our account at the bank. It is needless, at this stage of the proceedings, to trouble you with details. The money has unquestionably been stolen in the course of its transit from you to us. Certain peculiarities which we observe, relating to the manner in which the fraud has been perpetrated, lead us to conclude that the thief may have calculated on being able to pay the missing sum to our bankers before an inevitable discovery followed the annual striking of our balance. This would not have happened, in the usual course, for another 3 months. During that period, but for your letter, we might have remained perfectly unconscious of the robbery that has been committed. We mention this last circumstance, as it may help to show you that we have to do, in this case, with no ordinary thief. Thus far we have not even a suspicion of who that thief is. But we believe you will assist us in making some advance towards discovery, by examining the receipt forged, of course, which has no doubt purported to come to you from our house. Be pleased to look and see whether it is a receipt entirely in manuscript, or whether it is a numbered and printed form which merely requires the filling in of the amount. The settlement of this apparently trivial question is, we assure you, a matter of vital importance. Anxiously awaiting your reply, we remain, with high esteem and consideration, Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.